First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Duval, you soon have a chance to cast a ballot on an election that you might not have heard about. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, the special election coming up on your local Duval County ballot and why it affects you. Give us a call right now, 549-2937. Then later, a conversation with author and NPR reporter Tim Mack on his new book about the fall of the NRA. We'll go inside the pages of Misfire. All of that and more ahead, but first this morning, have you heard a special election is coming up in this city? That's right. Duval County mailed out more than 83,000 ballots last week for the City Council at Large Group 3 seat. It was recently vacated by the death of former mayor and former council president, Democrat Tommy Hazzouri. Now, this election will be the city's first since a new stricter election law took effect this summer in Florida. So who's on the ballot and why should you care? A.G. Gankarski is a contributor for our new newsletter and website, Jacksonville Today, and he's here to fill us in. A.G., always good to get your political insights. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
And as we talk about the special election and voting, give us a call, folks, 549-2937. Who will you vote for to replace the late Tommy Hazzouri? Or are you just now hearing about this? 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. So, AG, of course, Hazzouri was a much-loved local political figure. His death creates a plum opening for ambitious local politicians. The special election for this at-large Group 3 seat is coming up pretty soon. People need to mark their calendars and get out and vote. Let's talk about the legacy first and why these at-large seats are so coveted by people seeking an in into local politics.
Yeah, I mean, I think Mr. Hazzouri's legacy is definitely worth visiting on. He served the term as mayor. He was council president when he's on council. You know, he ran for council with the goal of being a council president. He told me that at the time, and he got what he wanted. And he had a very consequential presidency. It wasn't just a rubber stamp kind of presidency. You know, he stood up to the mayor on a number of issues. And, you know, those are big shoes to fill. You know, the at-large seats, we have five of them in Duval County, and they basically serve as like quasi-mayoral functions in many ways. Like somebody like Matt Carlucci, for example, you see him as a citywide commentator and acting on citywide issues. You know, Hazzouri was kind of in that role. I don't know if the person who wins this election is going to be able to get that kind of traction, because they're just running to fill the unexpired term of Hazzouri, which would have gone through June 2023. So it's going to be somebody who gets in there is going to be really filling in a slot for a limited amount of time, and they'll have to make decisions almost immediately about whether to run for re-election or not.
Yeah. And there's a separate conversation to have about whether we even need these at-large city council seats. You know, I mean, we've got this huge city council. Do we really need these extra members when there's a representative for every district?
You know, that's an interesting point, because Republicans increasingly dominate these at-large races. They have the money. They have the infrastructure. Hazzouri was an exception to that. Hazzouri had the best name recognition of any Democrat in the city. And that's why Republicans, you know, like Lenny Curry, coveted his endorsements, you know, and his backing on key issues, because he meant that much. But unless you're a Tommy Hazzouri, and there aren't too many of them out there, the at-large seats generally go to Republicans, because either they're more prepared for these citywide races at this point in time. We've seen that through a number of cycles. And the at-large races, just like the constitutional officer races, they're very tough pickups for Democrats usually.
I got an email last week from Janelle in Jacksonville. She said, "I'm frustrated that with a local election for city council just a few weeks away, there's been little to no coverage. These candidates are not widely known. Few people in the community are even aware that there is an election coming. We need to know about this election, what the candidates stand for, and we often complain that people don't get out and vote in off-year elections. Let's do more to inform and encourage people to vote. That's why we're talking to you right now, AG.
Right.
Let's explain who's on the ballot in this December 7th first election.
Okay, we had four candidates that ultimately qualified, two Republicans and two Democrats. The Democrat who's probably best known is Tracy Polson. She ran for State House in 2018 from a West Side district. She's since moved to the South Side, so she qualified for this race. Polson has a lot of backing from 2018. So over here in Avondale, where I am, I see a lot of her signs around and things like that. She also has the best fundraising. She has close to $150,000 banked. That's pretty good. The other Democrat in the race, James Jacobs, he has about $10,000, and he ran in 2019 for the same seat. He's the reason Tommy Azuri had to run a runoff, because he split the Democratic vote. So I'm not sure how much goodwill that buys him, but that's what he's known for. The Republicans, Nick Howland of the Firewatch, which is an anti-veteran suicide initiative, he is the establishment candidate. He has like the backing of your chamber types and, you know, all the Republican machine types that endorse these kind of candidates. And he's got about 90,000 banked. I have a feeling he's going to step up his fundraising because, you know, having lost the first fundraising report, like check to Polson, Polson had more money when we looked at fundraising reports first time. That's not where a Republican wants to be. So I expect to kind of save the whale movement for him. There's another Republican in the race too, Howdy Russell. He owns a restaurant. He's got about 10,000 banked. He's backed by a lot of the people who oppose things like the human rights ordinance expansion that codified civil rights for LGBT people. So that's where Howdy Russell comes from.
All right.
And yeah, so you've got four of these candidates and
four candidates. Yeah, yeah. So, but of course, as you just pointed out, the front runners are Republican Nick Howland and Democrat Tracy Polson. The deadline to register to vote for this election, if you aren't already registered, has already passed. Early voting begins November 27th, folks. In 2 weeks, the actual election day, the first balloting, is December 7th. If there's no clear winner, the top two vote getters move on to another election on February 22nd. Now, of course, the big problem with all of this, AG, for these candidates is a very small number of voters are going to decide who is the next city council person. The key is to even get people aware that this election is happening.
Yeah, and I've talked to pollsters who don't really know how to poll this race because how do you determine what a likely voter is for a race like this? You know, how do you guess what turnout's going to be? It's going to be in the single digits probably because nobody knows about this election. And that's kind of the thing. So when you look at that, you get a high variance in what could happen at the polls. You have to assume that, you know, Polson and Howland will be the front runners, but a lot can happen. You know, like Jacobs will cut into the Polson vote. And, you know, not every Democrat is, you know, gung-ho for Polson. I mean, we saw that in 2018 when she ran for State House. She underperformed in black precincts. Does that come back to haunt her in this election? Nick Howland, similarly, you know, he looks great on paper. But Howdy Russell, because he is the social conservative in the race, he will peel off some of that vote. It's similar to how Lenny Curry isn't universally popular with Republicans anymore because he's taken positions that have ticked him off over the years. So he's now 70% or whatever the polls say. So you're going to see some variance here. You're going to see some shear. And it's going to be hard to forecast. But I expect we're going to run off. Because I don't see the momentum for anybody to get 50% out of this.
Now, this will be the city's first election since Florida passed a new and stricter election law. It is being challenged by a slew of groups, including all 67 election supervisors in the state of Florida, both Republicans and Democrats. They say the law was unnecessary and too restrictive. The law was passed after former President Donald Trump made false claims of fraud during the 2020 election. So under this new law, voters who want a mail ballot have to ask for one every year instead of every 2 years. There are other restrictions, extra documentation people have to show to verify their identity and such. That will further restrict the franchise for this already very low turnout election, AG.
Yeah, I mean, to a point, and I think there will be isolated incidents that prove what you're saying, but because it is such a low-interest election, it will actually be kind of a testing point where people can figure out how things work under these new rules. I don't expect much of an effect because this just isn't a barn burner of an election. You know, this is something that is very much happening behind the scenes, and it's something we haven't really seen any of the narrative in yet. So mm-hmm. I don't think for the December 7th election, it's really going to be an issue.
549-2937. Give us a call. Did you even know you should get out and vote in a special election, Duval? The election day is December 7th, but early voting starts November 27th. 549-2937. Gail in Riverside. Hi, Gail. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Gail.
Okay. I just wanted to encourage people to get out and vote. I know that it seems like it's a small election, but it's these small elections of people running for this type of an office that eventually keep racking up to the next level and the next level, and we need to pay attention to our city council members and the people that are running. So, you know, when they get up to the very top, we can't do a whole lot about it. But when we're in the city council arena, we've got, you know, something in the game. And I think Tracy Polson really brings a lot to Jacksonville, especially on the mental health level, which I think we need some help in that area.
Thanks, Gail. Okay, so a Polson fan. We're also getting emails from people who say, I will vote for Nick Howland. I always vote Republican, and I will do so on this local ballot. Here's one more email from Sue. I've already sent in my vote for Tracy Polson. I feel like other candidates just run for a position advantageous to their political career. Okay, so fans on both sides. AG, though, what about the fact that voters have become aware, at least some of them, that these local elections matter, whether it's for school boards, city council? You know, most people couldn't name their state representative or their state senator or their congressman, but there is a subset of voters that's finally sort of tuning in to getting more engaged at the local level in these elections. And honestly, that's why we're talking about it right now, to get more people engaged in the local civic life of this community.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's true holistically, but I mean, we can look at 2019 and see the underperformance in the local elections here. The first election that decided mayor, it was three Republicans, and it was a very low turnout. The general election was even lower than that. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that happens when you have, like, one-party domination of political infrastructure. I mean, this is an election where if Tracy Polson can beat Nick Howland, it gives Democrats hope. It gives Democrats hope for the 2023 mayoral race with Donna Deegan probably being the franchise bearer for the Democrats. Gives them hope for those races and so on. But in terms of what the Polson or Howland choice will do for the city council, it won't be much because it's such a heavily Republican majority. Polson can serve as a check on the mayor on certain things. She can say certain things, but I think if she gets elected, she's not going to get the prime committees because she's going to be new to the council, and, you know, that will be their excuse to not give her, you know, great committee assignments. I think if Howland gets on the council, they're going to, like, showcase him a little bit because he's kind of the inside baseball guy. And, you know, this is going to be more of a showcase for him.
Here's an email from a listener. The benefit of an at-large commissioner versus a more regional rep is that the at-large people can look at what's best for the entire county versus being tied up with a smaller local point of view. that gets to the whole reason these at-large seats were created, AG, to help represent such a big city county. There have been moves, though, to do away with these positions. They haven't gone anywhere, but it's become more of an issue lately.
Yeah, it's one of Garrett Dennis's collections of bills that get filed and get deferred and kind of disappear. Yeah, it's tough because there are so many institutional forces that want the at-large seats as checks against districts and all of that. And, you know, you can see it. Sometimes you get these people, Republicans and Democrats, both have parochial visions about what's needed. You know, they can't look beyond their district. We've seen that as an impediment to downtown development and so on. But, you know, at the same time, if you look at the at-large seats, you got five of these people, you know, who aren't really accountable on the district level. So, you know, I think it's a limited accountability. It's kind of like being a professor emeritus or something. Mm. You're kind of a mayor. You kind of aren't. You kind of represent your district. You kind of don't. And it's something that I think may need to be reconsidered, but I don't expect it to be considered ultimately until charter revision or something like that down the road.
549-2937. John is downtown. Hi, John. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Melissa, and thank you for taking my call. AG, we need to go kayaking downtown, buddy.
But, I don't trust you, man.
Well, no, John, we're not talking. If this is John Nooney, we're not talking about the waterways. We're talking about the special election, okay?
That's like hunting with Dick Cheney. No, thank you.
I know. We're talking about the special election. And I'll tell you what, I'll be voting for Nick. And let me just see why, too. And AG, you know, here's one for you, too. But when's the last time you attended a committee meeting of the legislative Jacksonville City Council? And the reason I say that is public participation 2017-160 has been eroded. It really has. And so Joe Q. Public, you know, to address any concern, any legislative bill through the committee process is being taken away. Like, I'm heading to neighborhoods right now. And
John, I wish everyone was as engaged as you are in what our local representatives are doing.
But I'll tell you what, I haven't talked to the other three. I did mention it to Nick, and you know that is a concern. And I hope that you would ask every candidate, you know, between now and even if there's a runoff or whatever, will you restore the public trust by allowing, you know, Joe Q. Public to address something before a vote is taken.
Okay.
And then not be shut out or being removed, you know, from a committee meeting.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, I think John's comments get to a feeling of frustration that people have with the process itself. And we see public comment and city council shut down time and time again.
Yeah.
You see the room cleared.
They did it over the Confederate statue vote. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like they're not really a council president until they yell clear to chambers at least once. And, you know, that's kind of the irony there. So, you know, over the years, there's been less and less opportunity for people to have, you know, access to the process, as John complains, and all the committees allow for people to say anything and so on. I don't think anybody who wins this election is going to have anything to do about it because it's an abbreviated term. They're not going to be in a position to chair a committee or anything like that. So they can tell you anything they want. It's just going to be hypothetical until they run for and get elected to a full term.
Michael on the South Side. Go ahead, Michael.
Yes, hey, everybody. Michael on the South Side. So I would say one of the, John is right with this being like a one-term thing, basically the campaigns who are running have to be doing literally like block by block voter engagement in order to get this voter turnout, because again, every vote matters, every vote should be counted, so everybody should be literally voting in this election to get folks ready for the 2023. So
thanks, Michael.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, so go ahead, AG.
Yeah, I mean, Michael makes a great point about boots on the ground of this. I mean, knocking doors can be huge in this race, and this is where Polson has an advantage. She had a lot of volunteers in 2018. It seems like she has a lot of engagement this time around, too. So, you know, if you see a Polson person knocking on a door in your neighborhood and it's a Democratic or swing neighborhood, don't be surprised.
With all of that said, go to DuvalElections.com to learn more about the special election for City Council at-large Group 3. The deadline to register for the first election has already passed. Early voting starts in a couple of weeks. The election itself is December 7th. Early voting hours are 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at all early voting locations. And you can find those locations at the website DuvalElections.com. There are spots all across town to cast your ballot. If you want to vote by mail, you need to submit your request before the end of this month. Again, DuvalElections.com. If you live in Duval County, you need to get wise to this special election. A.G. Gankarski, read him at jackstoday.org and other locations on the web. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And much more still ahead later. Our own analyst Josh Torres with all the highlights from a busy sports weekend here in town. But up next.
So what was so interesting to me to write this book, Misfire, is that the NRA is such a black box.
We speak with author and NPR reporter Tim Mack on his new book, Misfire. We'll be right back.
The Florida Department of Health. A parent's choice protects their child for a lifetime. The choice to start and stick with the recommended vaccination schedule provides lifelong immunity to serious and preventable disease. Protection starts at thepowertoprotect.org.
Groove to Electro Lounge Radio around the clock. Allow the sounds of chill out, down-tempo, new jazz, and reggae to relax and inspire you. Download the WJCT app or visit wjct.org/jacksmusic to start listening today.
Welcome back. Well, the history of the NRA is long and complicated. It began as an institution formed right after the Civil War that taught soldiers marksmanship. But over the years, it has become a far-right political group with deep links to Russia. Now, author Tim Mack, an investigative reporter for NPR, has crafted a meticulously researched chronicle of the history of this organization that is as immersive as it is shocking. Using dozens of interviews with NRA staff and insiders, leaked documents, depositions, and more, Mack follows the NRA and two of its main figures, CEO and Executive Vice President Wayne LaPierre and his wife Susan. He tracks how this couple, along with many others, shifted the NRA's trajectory with a series of bad decisions and crimes and an emphasis on making and spending a lot of money. Last week, I spoke with Tim Mack about his fascinating new book. It's called Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. Here's that conversation. Tim Mack, it's great to be with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, this book, Misfire, is an astounding piece of investigative journalism. You've interviewed dozens of people to learn more about the inner workings of the NRA, particularly its CEO, Wayne LaPierre, and his wife, Susan. But you write that there really was no single event that brought the NRA down. It was a series of events and bad decisions. Tell us about this trajectory of the NRA that you track in your book, Misfire.
So what was so interesting to me to write this book, Misfire, is that the NRA is such a black box, right? We don't know very much about the organization, except what it wanted to put out into the public realm. I think this is a story about personalities and people, conflicts. It's a story about, you know, jealousy, greed, and betrayal. I mean, this is a book about the leaders and personalities and what they did behind the scenes and why the NRA is in decline. The book starts with this scene at Wayne LaPierre. He's the CEO and executive vice president of the NRA. It starts at his wedding in the late 90s, and he doesn't want to get married on that day. And he tells his friends that, and his best man says, well, hey, I don't think you should get married either. Puts a $100 bill on the dashboard of the car and says, hey, we can drive out of here right now. But Wayne LaPierre is ultimately convinced to go through with the wedding and the ceremony by the priest and Susan LaPierre. And you know, it leads to this very awkward scene in which he goes through with the ceremony but can't make eye contact with the bride. And why do I tell this story, and why is that important? I mean, the personalities really predicted the future of how the NRA would go and what its flaws were. The people around the NRA realized that Wayne LaPierre was kind of a weak-willed person who could be bullied into approving anything if yelled at long enough and pushed around long enough. And this has led to millions of dollars in sweetheart deals for the NRA's contractors, golden parachutes for NRA executives, and millions of dollars of documented misconduct and misspending inside the NRA.
What's fascinating to me, and what I didn't realize until reading your book, is that Wayne LaPierre isn't actually a fan of guns. He doesn't really hunt. He's not a true believer like so many NRA members are. You write that for him, it was really more about having the money. Is that right?
The money, the influence. An interesting anecdote is that, you know, Wayne LaPierre was not only not particularly interested or obsessed with firearms, but he's downright dangerous with them at times. You know, there's an incident in which someone calls out his name and he spins around and points the gun at the person who was calling out to him. There's a joke inside NRA headquarters that if you didn't, you know, do well at your job, you might have to, quote, go hunting with Wayne or go shooting with Wayne. Mm. It was just well known that he's this awkward fellow. But what's the irony of this is that Wayne LaPierre is, despite being kind of personally anxious and scared at all times, he's also the head of the most powerful and controversial organizations in America.
What about the Sandy Hook shooting? You write about the internal problems at the NRA that weakened it, but external events were a factor too. Can you talk a little bit about that mass shooting in particular, along with so many others that have given new fuel to the gun reform movement?
Sandy Hook was just such a pivotal moment just for the NRA and for the gun safety movement in America. For the NRA, it was a moment where they decided strategically that they were much less interested in reaching out to Democrats and other folks kind of in the center, and decided that they were going to reach out almost entirely to conservatives and Republicans and double down on a kind of conservative culture war approach in order to boost fundraising and membership. For the other side of the equation, the other side of the debate, on the gun safety movement side, Sandy Hook was the start of a new movement, which has grown to rival the NRA. You know, a lot of folks in the gun safety movement wanted new legislation after Sandy Hook. And in their frustration, there's been this enormous kind of growth in the grassroots gun safety movement, to the extent that by 2018, the gun safety movement actually outspent the NRA and gun rights groups in political spending.
Speaking of spending, talk a little bit about how the NRA has deepened ties to Russia and Russian money and what that has meant for our politics.
So there's just been a really interesting episode in the NRA's misconduct over the last few years involving this woman named Maria Butina. Now, Maria Butina is this Russian citizen who for years was using the NRA to her benefit. They were, that Butina was someone who was networking in Washington, D.C., and trying to advance the interests of the Russian government. And the NRA just got totally ruled by her, and that ended up spending money on her travel, her networking, her kind of development, and ultimately, Maria Butina gets charged with being an unregistered Russian agent. She's convicted of one of those charges and ultimately goes to prison for it and deported. It's one of those episodes that show how organized the NRA has been, how easily played it was, and how chaotic it was inside the organization.
And what about the perception that the NRA is, in fact, a Russian asset, that it is in service to Vladimir Putin and his goal of destabilizing this country and the West?
You know, one of the interesting threads of reporting in the book is how closely Russian influence operations mirrored NRA messaging in the 2016 timeframe. How you could see the NRA's messaging, their Instagram posts or Twitter posts, the language in that was actually used by what is now this infamous Russian troll farm in St. Petersburg called the Internet Research Agency. And you could see the Russian government through the Internet Research Agency using messaging that was mirroring what the NRA was doing. On all sorts of issues, the Russian government would take both sides of the issue, from, you know, abortion to all sorts of very hot topic issues in the United States. But on guns, what you found is it really only took one side, which is the NRA's side. And that was a very interesting development over the last few years.
Now, the lawsuits have been raining down. New York Attorney General Letitia James in August of last year filed a lawsuit against the NRA trying to dissolve it all together. The NRA has filed for bankruptcy. This week, Giffords, the nonprofit founded by former Arizona Congresswoman Gabby Giffords that's focused on gun reform and gun safety, that group filed a federal lawsuit accusing the NRA of violating campaign finance laws dating back to 2014. So is this all death by a thousand cuts? Tim Mack, could the NRA eventually cease to exist? Where do you see this going?
So the NRA was originally founded in New York, right? So the New York Attorney General, as you mentioned, Letitia James, she and the Charities Bureau in New York has jurisdiction over the NRA as a nonprofit. And after a long investigation, the New York Attorney General found more than $60 million worth of misspending and misconduct by senior NRA executives over just a few short years. And as part of the lawsuit that the New York Attorney General filed against the NRA, they are asking a judge to dissolve the NRA in its entirety. That is, arguing that the organization is so corrupt from top to bottom and so unworthy of nonprofit status that it should be dismantled. What happens next in that case is going to be so critical to the NRA's existence, the gun politics in this country, and the future of what happens with regards to firearms and the laws around it.
Given that there's such deeply held support for the Second Amendment in the United States, if the NRA were to no longer exist, wouldn't something else spring up to take its place, do you think?
Well, right now there's no other game in town. But what's true is that the NRA's greatest asset is their millions of members. And the NRA ceasing to exist. I mean, if you imagine a world in which the NRA doesn't exist, those members would still be there with the same views as they had the day before. And that's really an interesting point to make about the difference between the NRA's decline and other kind of questions in NRA politics and the debate over what the right law should be in America with regards to guns.
It's a fascinating book, and I thank you for your time. He's NPR Washington investigative correspondent Tim Mack. The book is Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA, and it's out now. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it was a busy weekend around town and beyond for sports. Everything from football to skateboarding to a surf pro event. Our director, Josh Torres, was very busy covering it all, and he's got a recap, beginning with the Jaguars. Hey, Josh.
Hey there, Melissa.
All right, so the Jags were on the high, beating the Bills last week, headed out to Indy to take on the Colts. Unfortunately, that didn't go quite as well.
No, it did not. This is a game where, again, the Jags were probably trying to ride the high of beating the Bills, a really, really good team, and really trying to show the world that this wasn't just a fluke, that the Jags were actually going to take you the distance at the very least. James Robinson was able to be cleared to play after coming back from a heel bruise. But unfortunately, the Colts brought them right back down to earth. This game got out of hand a little quickly. The Colts took an early 3-0 lead, but then on the very next possession, the Jags had a punt blocked and returned for a touchdown, making it 10-0. Eventually, the Colts made it 17-0. The Jags did get helped out by a field goal and then a 66-yard by Jamal Agnew to go into the half down 20-9. They did end up pulling the game within reach after a James Robinson touchdown to make it 20-17. But unfortunately, Trevor Lawrence had the ball less than a minute to go, 50 seconds left, and he unfortunately did fumble it. So the Jags ended up losing 23-17. They fall to 2-7. One of the biggest takeaways that everybody had was just passes being dropped by receivers. That just can't happen. The execution, and a lot of people don't know, is it just the receivers aren't doing their job properly? Is it miscommunication with them and Trevor Lawrence, or what's going on? But there's just that's one of the biggest sticking points of the last few weeks has been, ever since DJ Chark got hurt, that the receivers are just not executing the plays they need to, and you got to have that. I mean, that is your job, is to catch those passes and get downfield, and it's just not happening. And Trevor Lawrence, again, just had a very unspectacular game. He was 16 for 35 for 162 yards, had the late fumble that unfortunately did cost the game.
Well, what about that? I mean, there were such high hopes pinned on this kid.
Yeah, and that is one of the things. Don't get me wrong, Trevor Lawrence has the talent, but the problem is if you don't put the other people around him, and that's what a lot of fans are seeing, is that the team almost went, oh, we got Trevor Lawrence, you know, he's going to make everybody better. But you don't do that. You know, look at Tom Brady down in Tampa. Tom Brady is an amazing quarterback, easily the best of his generation, but he still has the weapons around him that help him do that. He knows it with confidence that they're going to catch those passes. They're going to get the yardage that he needs. And it seems like the Jags almost put all their money in on Trevor making everybody better, but you got to put the money around him too to make the entire team better. And the team now is going into this Sunday at TIA Bank Field against the San Francisco 49ers, and they need to get it turned around and hopefully win a couple more games this season to really at least have something going into the next year.
Sure. All right, let's talk college football briefly. Florida, Georgia, and FSU all playing.
Yep. Florida took on Samford, and this is a game that, man, oh man, Samford came into the game, I think it was a 37-point underdog. They were up at halftime 42-35 over the Florida Gators. This was absolutely insane to see. The Gators did eventually go on to win 70-52, but the fact that it took them that far to, you know, yeah, you scored 70 points, but then the team that came in as a 37-point underdog scored 52 on you. So, and Dan Mullen, his seat is beginning hotter and hotter and hotter for the last couple weeks. And a lot of people think that this could be the end for him, especially after just signing a brand new extension this summer. Then you go up to, and you see Georgia took on Tennessee. Hey, everybody, Tennessee managed to score 17 points on the Bulldogs, the first team to score more than 13 on the Bulldogs all season, but the Bulldogs scored 41 on them, so they won 41-17, still showing that they are the most dominant team in the country, still ranked number one and really looking strong going into these final couple weeks of play. And then FSU took on Miami. FSU got a much-needed win, 31-28 over the Hurricanes in a big rivalry matchup. The Hurricanes lost on absolute heartbreaking fashion on a botched spike at the end of the game. College rules are that you do have to have at least 4 seconds on the clock if you're going to spike the ball. Miami only had two. Quarterback spiked the ball. Ref came out. Game over. Unfortunately, they could not get it back. And they fought back from a 17-0 deficit just to get... They took the lead late. FSU scored with a little under 30 seconds to play. Miami had the chance and unfortunately botched it.
Too bad. But on the other hand, this is really cool. It was a sold-out crowd this weekend downtown. Some of the best skaters in the world came to the riverfront for the Street League Skateboarding Super Crown Championship. I saw them setting up for this, Josh. It looked really fun.
It was. I got to go out to that, and it was great to watch. I think it was one of those things where it's something new. You know, you're used to seeing basketball, football, hockey, baseball, all that here, but seeing some of the best skaters in the world out there was great. The crowd was electric. They were cheering like crazy, seeing some of the best skaters in the world. Pamela Rosa from Brazil won the women's title over, and this is the part that's crazy, over two skaters. One of them from Brazil, she's 13. The other one from Japan is 14.
Get out of here.
The best part is the 13-year-old has an Olympic silver medal. The 14-year-old has a gold medal.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm 26. I don't have any medals. That is crazy. And then Jagger Eaton from the U.S. won the men's title, and he actually won it before he even had his last run of the day and got to do a great victory run for the fans. And he even mentioned afterward how great it was seeing the crowd out there. And that was the one thing all the skaters had to say all weekend was, the crowd was actually electric here in Jacksonville, and a lot of people are hoping that they maybe make this a regular stop for them.
I hope so, too. And it just a beautiful setting right there on the riverfront
right
for that.
Right there on the water.
Yeah, really cool. Speaking of water, you also checked out the Supergirl Surf Pro event at Jack's Beach over the weekend.
Yep, the World Surf League held the Supergirl Surf Pro event here at Jacksonville Beach. The waves weren't exactly the greatest out there, but they were able to still get their contest done, and Alyssa Spencer beat Carolyn Marks to win the event. It was her second career qualifying series win, and that made her the number one women's surfer in the North America regional rankings.
Wow. Okay. Last but not least, as if all of that wasn't enough, there was basketball and volleyball going on around town this weekend, too.
Oh, yes. So we're going to do a quick recap of some of the local teams here for college basketball. UNF men's basketball, they always start off their season playing a lot of non-conference games against some very tough opponents. So unfortunately, unsurprisingly, they have dropped all of those matchups against Texas Tech, Texas A&M, and Grand Canyon University. The Texas A&M game was actually a lot closer than a lot of people expected, but you know, this is the kind of thing that their coach really shoots for, to get them against those tough opponents. UNF women's basketball team lost their first game to FSU, but actually have won their last two home games, including a game on Saturday where they almost broke a women's NCAA basketball record for most team assists. They came within two of breaking that record. JU's men's basketball team won both of their games to start their season off 2-0, and JU's women's basketball won their only matchup so far, but it was against a Big Ten opponent. It's the first time they've beaten a Big Ten opponent in the program's history. They beat Minnesota 69-66. And the last thing I wanted to talk about, I want to send a big congratulations to the Edward Waters University women's volleyball team. They won the Gulf Coast Athletic Conference title, and they're going to their first ever NAIA national tournament berth. So very huge congratulations to them for getting that tournament berth, and we really hope that they make a good run out of it.
That's fantastic. So much happening this weekend. It really was such an active weekend, and it's so great to have you bringing us up to date on Mondays. Follow Josh on Twitter at Josh is a Polar Bear. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
All right. In a moment, we're going to take a spin through the Jacksonville music experience. This is an interesting story. Our arts and culture editor, Matt Shaw, will drop by to tell us how a shortage of vinyl, is affecting local musicians and the local music scene. That's coming up next.
Lee and Kate's Glass, family-owned and operated for 95 years. Lee and Kate's Glass is your source for upgrading your home's glass, from shower doors and mirrors to windows and tabletops. Learn more at leeandkatesglass.com.
UF Health North, a comprehensive medical campus, including 24-hour emergency care for children and adults, a 92-bed hospital, outpatient surgery, rehabilitation, advanced imaging, and more. Learn more at north.ufhealthjax.org.
Next time on The World, testing drugs to treat COVID-19. Some of them work, some don't, so doctors rely on drug trials.
I suggested to everyone, okay, we are working together, so let's give the name together to our trial, because this is all about collaboration.
Researchers team up to find effective treatments for people who get COVID-19 inside one drug trial on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, how do two sisters just 3 years apart take radically divergent paths in life? We talk with Dawn Turner, former columnist for the Chicago Tribune, about her new memoir. While she became a successful writer, her sister died at 24 from chronic alcoholism. Both grew up in a Chicago neighborhood which Turner says government officials neglected and abandoned. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Every 4 years, we the people get to decide how America's political landscape is reshaped. But once every 10, states reconfigure new district boundaries that usually end up favoring one side over the other. Who's drawing the lines this time? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the shortage of vinyl is turning the tables on our local music scene. So says our WJCT Arts and Culture editor, Matt Shaw. He's been writing about this at the Jacksonville Music Experience. Hey, Matt, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
All right. So what's going on? There's a shortage of vinyl?
Yeah. So I think the thing that you have to understand is that vinyl records never really went away.
Yeah.
In the 80s and 90s, they became kind of the domain of independent record labels and the dwindling number of independent record stores around the country. And then in the 2000s, when everything switched to streaming services and CDs fell out of favor, they became vinyl records became a lifeline to independent artists as they were touring the country. It was a nice artifact where fans of their music could purchase a record, $25, $30, and it would, help supplement your income. And a lot of these artists were losing out on streaming services, which pay very little to, independent artists.
Right. As you write in at jacksmusic.org, if you're Adele or Taylor Swift or someone like that, you can make a lot on streaming. If you're a small up-and-coming band like LPT in Jacksonville, you need those vinyl sales.
Right. And that's something we've written about this on jacksmusic.org as well. Just the pro rata system of streaming services like Spotify, where the majority of that money goes to the artists who have, tens of millions of plays, your Taylor Swift's, your Adele's, your Beyonce's, and independent artists make pennies from Spotify, if anything.
Okay, so is this a supply chain issue like everything else right now?
Yeah, there are an estimated maybe 36 manufacturers of vinyl records around the country, and a lot of them are small, like Vinyl Record Pressing, which is here in Atlantic Beach in Jacksonville, used to doing under 10,000 units. Most of the time, even much smaller runs, 300 to 500 records for an independent artist. And so you have Walmart and Target and places like that, large retailers coming into the market who are selling vinyl, and they're selling Taylor Swift, they're selling Adele. And Adele got a lot of flack recently for an order of 500,000 units of her latest record, which she put on press this summer, which was spread out. The production of this was spread out among dozens of vinyl manufacturers and created kind of a logjam for all the other artists who are trying to put their records on press.
That is so interesting. So what's a scrappy local band to do? What do they do about this?
Well, right now they're being told, at best 6 to 8 months to get their record back. A lot of them have been told not until sometime in 2022. I've heard estimates of a year before you get your record back. And so there's ideas floating around there. There's artists who are just hitting the road without new vinyl, which is a struggle. There's artists who are looking at cassettes, which have also made...
cassettes are coming back?
Cassettes have made a little bit of a run, even smaller scale, smaller independent artists, but they are... The price point for a cassette is a fraction of the cost of a vinyl record.
Most cars don't even have a cassette deck anymore. No. How do you play... Like, where would you play a cassette?
Right. Yeah, you have to go hunt down a cassette player at a Goodwill.
Oh, my gosh.
Or a thrift store.
You know, I still have mixtapes that people, like old boyfriends, that used to be a thing.
Yeah,
kids, if a guy liked you, he'd make you a mixtape on cassette of all these meaningful songs.
Yeah.
And that was really a romantic thing to do. I still have those in my collection that my husband made for me many years ago. I can't believe people are now actually doing this again.
It might be time for you to seek out a cassette player.
I guess so. So this is so interesting. And, you know, I really encourage everyone to go to jacksmusic.org for more about this. Because as we come out of this pandemic and we deal with these supply chain issues, you cover arts and culture in this city. And there's so much happening.
There's a lot happening, yeah. And we talked to local manufacturers in this story, and we talked to local artists like LPT, who their first record they pressed on vinyl, and it's basically sold out now, and they're waiting. They don't even have a date in hand when they can get their new vinyl out there, and they're just sitting on their hands waiting to get that so they can make some money off their art.
And, you know, for people that have never picked up a vinyl album, and I'm talking to, I don't know, my kids, they've seen them in the garage and they've said, what are those?
Mm-hmm. Big CDs.
Yeah. Vinyl, there's just something cool about the way a vinyl record sounds.
It is. A lot of people will say, and this really depends on your sound system too. If you're buying a $100 turntable from Urban Outfitters, the sound is not going to be high quality, but vinyl record still remains the best listening experience if you have good speakers and a good receiver.
Mm-hmm. Check it all out at jacksmusic.org. Really interesting. And he's our arts and culture editor, Matt Shaw. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Melissa.
And thanks for listening, everybody. That is our show. Our senior producer is Heather Schatz. She's got a collection of vinyl. I'm not sure if Josh Torres does. He's shaking his head no. No vinyl. Josh is our excellent director. We're also pleased to have a team that includes associate producer Catherine Hobbs, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and news editor Randy Rogusky. And you, keep your emails coming. We love your feedback. Drop us a line at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Catch our podcast later today, wherever you like to listen. You can always listen through the WJCT app. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a safe and happy start to your work week.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.